Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Monday, March 14, 2022. The time is 1:32 p.m. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Keel, Senator Hughes, Senator Meyer, and myself as chair, Senator Myers, and myself as chair, Senator Holland. Senator Schauer will not be he's excused today. We do have a quorum to conduct business, though. Thank you to Nancy, our recording secretary, and Nate, our moderator for today. And as a reminder, please silence your cell phones if you have them on board. We will start today's hearing with the consideration of three appointees by the governor. Up first will be Ms. Marsh Prax. Ms. Prax, if you care to come up to the presenter's table. And get yourself comfortable and draw that microphone in a little tight. And if you would, state your name, any affiliation that you care to cater to. And do you have any prepared comments for today?
I do.
Okay. Well, state your name, any affiliation, and begin your prepared presentation.
My name is Mae Marsh, and I came here today to introduce myself and also to ask for your support in my nomination to the State of Alaska Commission on Human Rights. I've lived in Alaska since 1990, except for 2 years when I ran away to Europe and to the East Coast. I'm a wife, a mother, a grandmother, and a great-grandmother. And my family is a blending of race, culture, ethnicity, and also ability. As a young girl growing up in segregation, I really struggled to blend together my church's message of red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight, with my dad's racist attitude, because segregation didn't support that coming together. I struggled with this, and I watched as the civil rights unfolded on the black and white TV screen and in my local community of Frederick, Maryland. And I found solace and I found solutions in the civil rights laws. And my passion, my appetite for justice eventually became my vocation. I worked at Fort Wainwright for 20 years. I started as an analyst, and then I was the director of equal employment opportunity for Forts Richardson, Wainwright, and Greeley. My next assignment was in the Netherlands. And there, my EEO program focused on conflict resolution within an international workforce. My 27-year federal career was crowned with service at the agency level when I took the reins as deputy director of EEO for the Defense Contract Management Agency. From the East Coast, I came back home to Alaska. And here in Alaska, I was the Director of Diversity and Equal Opportunity at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And there I oversaw civil rights investigations and compliance. I believe I'm a perfect fit for ASHER because their goal of eliminating and preventing discrimination is a direct match with my skill set. My knowledge as a boots-on-the-ground practitioner has given me insight into the civil rights laws and an experience in applying the civil rights laws. All of my EEO positions contained a vital element of compliance, and I served as the advisor to top military and education officials and leaders. I'm skilled in complaints processing, civil rights investigations, conflict management, facilitation, mediation, training, and I have done some case review. Even though I'm now retired, I stay committed to equality of opportunity, and I am a stickler for due process. As the citizen that enjoys the protections and the freedoms of this beautiful state, I believe that it's time for me to pay back, because citizenship takes responsibility and it takes work. And it is my hope that my pragmatic approach and my honor for the rule of law will allow me to serve this beautiful state. And so I ask for your support in my nomination. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Marsh. Your equal employment opportunity background looks like an excellent fit as an appointee for the Alaska Commission for Human Rights. Are there any questions to the committee? Senator Q.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Marsh, thanks for being here today. Mm-hmm. I agree with the chairman. It's a tremendous resume for a commission like this. Sort of an open-ended question, a little bit of the vision thing. This commission is like a number of other state agencies. We've given them more missions than we funded them to do, right? That's not uncommon.
Right.
So a question for you, sort of how you see your the commission and your service. Do we have the balance right between education and complaints? And what do you see as the commissioner's relationship with setting that balance with the staff?
Well, that's kind of a tough question because my boots are not on the ground yet, and I would hate to offer advice that was not that I didn't really do the proper investigation of and have facts. And I haven't been inside the commission, so I don't know everything or how it operates, but I sure would like to take a rain check on that question.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to follow up.
Say again? Do you have a follow-up? Okay. I will tell you, 14 months ago, I didn't know about this job. It's a learning curve. Any other questions from the committee? Seeing no other questions, Senator Hughes.
I just want to thank you for stepping up. Indeed, an impressive resume, and thank you for sharing your background growing up that laid a foundation for what you did. So that is helpful. And I guess I don't really have a question. I'm just, you were getting paid for doing what you're going to do. You know, out of just servanthood, out of public service, and I that's one of the reasons why I'm impressed. But sounds like, you know, you could do a lot of other things. Why are you choosing this particular thing after you've devoted your entire life? I'm sure there are other things you might want to pursue. I'm just curious because you've already given a tremendous, even though you were being paid, you were in the public sector for many of those years giving. And now you're going to do it without pay. So just what's the motivation? Are you crazy that you just want to keep doing it? Or
maybe
are you seeing a problem and a need? I'm just curious what, besides just wanting to, that general statement that we often hear, oh, I want to give back. Is there something particular why you want to give back on this issue even more years?
I see some shift, and I believe that there is a foundation in the law, and I would like to see that carried forward to make sure that my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren benefit as I have and as others have under this law. And so I see this as my way to use the knowledge and the skills that I have to ensure that that goes forward. And, yeah, that's a non-paying position if you look at money. But if you look at how it pays in so many other ways, it is so well worth it. And I would be absolutely honored to do that for my state.
All right.
Just a follow-up comment. So it's a generational investment, and I can appreciate that as a grandparent as well. So thank you.
All right. With no other questions from the committee, Ms. Marsh, especially appreciation for coming in person. It's kind of nice that we're getting more and more people coming in person for these kind of events. I know you may have an appointment in another House Judiciary Committee today. We will open up public testimony shortly for all the appointees, but you don't have to be here for that. You're welcome to make it off to your next appointment.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thanks.
All right. So next up, we will have David Ross, and he is being considered for the Alaska Police Standards Council. He's on courtesy of Teams today, and there's Mr. Ross. If you would, please state your name, your affiliation, and your location for the record.
My name is David Ross, and I'm the police chief for the city of Kenai.
And one thing they have us documenting now, when people come in by Teams or on the phone, they like to know where you're at. Are you in Kenai today?
I'm in my office in Kenai, yes.
Thanks so much. Do you have any prepared remarks for the committee?
I do have a brief remark. So thank you, Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today for consideration for my appointment. My appointment is to the Alaska Police Standard Council. It's for one of the four police chief positions on the council. As I said, I'm currently the police chief in Kenai. I've been at the Kenai Police Department going on 21 years, with almost 6 years of those as the police chief. My entire law enforcement career has been at the Kenai Police Department, where I've filled all the roles from police officer to investigator to sergeant to lieutenant, and now the chief. I've lived in Kenai, the Kenai area, here for over 50 years, since 1971. I look forward to my role on the council as an opportunity to help continue to address the need for a very professional and well-trained law enforcement workforce in Alaska. I'm honored to be considered for the position, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Ross, or Police Chief Ross. Question from the committee. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Chief Ross, thanks for being with us today. Appreciated you reaching out by email. The question I asked then, and I hope you just expand on a little bit today here on the record, was that the council put out some proposed new training rules, and those didn't end up getting adopted. And you had some thoughts, I think, about additional training and how to do that in ways that made sense, especially for remote police departments, those police departments that aren't right directly connected to large urban centers. Could you talk a little bit about how you see the council advancing police training from where it's been in the past?
Senator Keel, through the chair. The council didn't adopt those regulations, but I think we're still going to consider them maybe in smaller pieces as time goes on. So that idea of in-service training for law enforcement may still be addressed by the council at some point. I guess what I would like to see, one of the things I discussed in that email with you, was that if we're going to, as a state, mandate in-service training, and we're going to as the regulation indicated, decide every year what that might be, that the state, through APSC or DPS, might consider providing that in-service training through an online portal, that every officer in the state could be seeing the same training, and it would be available to everybody instead of every agency trying to come up with training that complies with some particular standard. That was my thought on that. I think if we move toward that, most agencies in the state have in-service training standards. Ours at the Kenai Police Department are above what would be regulated. I think it's a good idea to have in-service standards. I think ongoing training is critical to law enforcement. So I hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Ross, for stepping up in your willingness to serve. And I just noticed reviewing your resume that you made a mid-career change, that you were in road construction industry. Curious what motivated you to switch into law enforcement, and because we do have difficulty, for instance, recruiting troopers and things, I'm just curious what caught your attention and made you switch paths, and does having a background outside of law enforcement, will that maybe help you, particularly as you're dealing with new law enforcement officers, in that you didn't go into it right after high school?
You know, I think having had some career outside of law enforcement has always brings some good perspective to people that we hire. To have been around people in other workforces and other places, I think it does. So it wasn't a totally new idea to me. My father worked a full career in law enforcement in Kenai and retired from here before I started. So I lived in a home that had law enforcement, and so I had an interest all along. I worked in a family road construction business for 15 years, from my teenage years until I turned about 30, and before I decided to take this route. But it wasn't new to me, the idea. It was always interesting.
Thank you.
And I'll commend you on your career. Over 20 years, all at the City of Kenai Police Department, making your way up through the ranks, officer, sergeant, lieutenant, police chief. Once again, I think you're an excellent candidate for the Police Standards Council. Are there any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, Chief Ross, thank you for presenting yourself here in front of the committee. And at this point, what we'll probably do is move on to the next candidate. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, next up will be Lonzo Henderson, and he is an appointee to the Alaska Commission for Human Rights. He's on the phone today. And Mr. Henderson, if you can hear me, we'll just start off with stating your name, your affiliation, and your location for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman, and other members of the committee. My name is Lonzo Henderson, and I'm calling from Anchorage, Alaska.
All right. Thank you for joining us today. Do you have any prepared remarks for the committee?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman.
Please proceed.
My name is Lonzo Henderson, and I'm thankful for the opportunity to appear before you today for confirmation to the board for the Alaska State for Human Rights for the great state of Alaska. I'll begin with a little about myself. I've been a lifelong Alaskan for over 50 years, together with my belated wife and our daughter. I appreciate walking to enjoy the remarkable Alaska native views. I also enjoy tending to our vegetable garden. My late wife loved flowers and a vegetable garden, and it's a hobby I still enjoy in her honor of her legacy. Due to the pandemic, I was fond of traveling, and my favorite trip was to attend the Hot Air Balloon Festival in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm a former Vietnam-era Army veteran, and I joined the Department of Corrections in the 1980s. I began my career as a probation parole officer and retired as the deputy director of the Division of Probation Parole. In 2008, I was appointed as a member of the Alaska Board of Parole and was appointed as the Parole Board Chair in 2011 until my tenure ended in 2019. I believe that all Alaskans have a right to be treated fairly, and I've also seen how bias can distort and instructure cooperation of business standard operating policies and procedures. Back to my experience, I've had many years of experience evaluating legal paperwork and making reasonable and just decisions in meetings and legal settings. Although the cases with this board are civil cases, I believe my experience with corrections and education with a BA in psychology, with a minor in sociology, and a Master of Art in teaching would prove to be an asset to this board. And I'm available for any questions that the chair or members have.
All right, thank you, Mr. Henderson. Are there any questions? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Henderson, I'll pose the same question I posed to the other nominee for this board. The balance between outreach and education and taking complaints and the adjudication role of this commission, is it your sense that we have that right? And how do you see the board members' interaction with the staff on that issue?
Again, I'm very new to and the appointment process, and I haven't had a chance to really evaluate how that all unfolds with the agency. But I would be happy to get back with you as I get more information to give you a better response to that question.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Keel. Any other questions from the committee? Seeing no other questions from the committee, I'll just say I see that you had put in for maybe the Clemency Advisory Board, and human rights was your third choice. Was that something that they approached you with, or was it a change that you had initiated? In other words, you're okay with being on the human rights board, correct?
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, Mr. Henderson, thank you so much for presenting yourself. Bring yourself before the committee today. At this point, we'll move on to a little bit more of the paperwork, but I see no other questions from the committee. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and I thank you for your continued support.
All right. So next up,
is he excused?
Oh, yes. All right. Sorry about that. All right, so at this point, I'm going to open up public testimony for these three appointees. Public testimony is now open for Ms. May Marsh, Alonzo Henderson, and David Ross. Anyone in the room wish to provide public testimony on these, any of these three appointees? Seeing no one in the room, and I don't believe I see anyone online. There's correct, no one online. All right, so public testimony is now closed. Public testimony is closed on these three appointees. Senator Myers, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that the record reflected in accordance with AS 39.50.080, the Senate Judiciary Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointments be forwarded to a joint session of the legislature for consideration. David Ross for the Alaska Police Standards Council, Lonzo Henderson for the State Commission on Human Rights, and May Marsh Prox for the State Commission on Human Rights.
All right, hearing no objection, the motion passes. And I will note that signing the reports regarding appointments to boards and commissions in no way reflects individual members' approval or disapproval of the appointees. The nominations are merely forwarded to the full legislature for confirmation or rejection. At this point, we'll do a brief at ease to sign some paperwork. Senate Judiciary Committee is back on the record. I will now bring Senate Bill 115 before the committee. Senate Bill 115 is related to providing a confidential address to certain persons. This is the first hearing of Senate Bill 115 in Senate Judiciary. Senator Keel, thank you for taking place at the presenter's table. If you care to introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Jesse Keel. I have the privilege of representing Senate District Q. I'm joined by my staff, Edric Carrillo. Senate Bill 115 is prompted by two true stories, and I'll just tell them briefly. The first actually was told by a former member of the Senate who is no longer a legislator, but once worked in victim services. And she told the story of helping a survivor who had escaped a terrible situation and started a new life here in Alaska, had a post office box, and to her shock, one day going to get her mail, that survivor was coming up toward the post office and saw her abuser, who had somehow tracked down her P.O. box number and was waiting outside the post office. And by good observation and good luck, she saw her abuser first. The second story is a friend of mine who is a law enforcement officer who I've had numerous conversations with about his fear for his own family. Our law enforcement officers deal with all sorts of Alaskans on their worst days, but every now and then they are forced to deal with the Alaskans that you and I would rather not, and for the best of reasons. People who behave in horrible ways and whose threats of revenge that law enforcement officer takes very, very seriously. Senate Bill 115 helps out folks in both those situations. It follows the basic model that 40 other states have taken for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking who choose to restart their lives in a new place for their own safety and the safety of their children. It provides an address where those survivors can have their mail sent that would otherwise be a public where the address would otherwise be a public record. And that mail is forwarded by a government agency to the survivor's actual address, which is kept confidential. The risk of their abuser, of their stalker, showing up at their post office goes away. In some states, these are housed in the Lieutenant Governor or Secretary of State's office because voter registration addresses are the primary public record that might reveal their addresses. In some states, these programs are housed within departments of law or district attorney's office equivalents as part of victim witness services. This bill proposes to put this in the Department of Administration simply because Shared Services of Alaska already operates a central mail system and has infrastructure in place. The mechanics of the bill are relatively simple. In addition to adjusting a few rules for the Alaska courts to make sure that these addresses don't inadvertently show up in a public court file that you can get down at the courthouse, it also creates the program and gives the Department of Administration significant leeway to define the scope of that program by regulation. In most states, those regulations say things like, we're only going to forward first-class registered and certified mail. If somehow this address gets on a commercial list, the catalogs are not getting forwarded. Or perhaps more importantly and more directly on point, a voter would get, if they chose a mail ballot, they would get their ballot forwarded. But those of us who run for office and send campaign mail third class, that would not get forwarded. Mr. Chairman, we have worked with the Department of Administration. We've worked with some law enforcement folks. You'll see support from law enforcement and correctional officers as well, and victims advocates to get support for this bill. We've heard no opposition, and so I hope that the committee can support Senate Bill 115 and provide an extra measure of safety for survivors and for our law enforcement and correctional officers. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Keel. Members should find a work draft labeled 32-0380/G in your packets. And I will go to Senator Myers for a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt work order 0380/ I have Bravo listed.
That should be Golf.
All right. /Gulf as a proposed committee substitute for Senate Bill 115 as our working document.
And I will object for discussion, and I will confirm with Mr. Carrillo, because I believe he's been explaining the changes in the CS. And if you'd care to place yourself on the record and also just confirm that we're looking at Lima Sierra 0380/G as in Gulf.
Thank you, Chair Holland. That is correct. That is the draft that we have, and there's two changes. Very technical changes that we made. So the first change you'll see is under Section 6, specifically Subsection H. Prior draft to the bill put under the unlawful disclosure of enrollees to include the subsections 1, 2, and 3, which was not the intention. So that actually, with the new draft, it puts the whole Section C in, which includes peace officers and correctional officers. The next addition or change was that we just updated the effective date to be February 1st, 2023, rather than 2022.
I thought I saw that when it was in State Affairs. All right. So is there any other discussion on this Senate Senate Bill 115. Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Senator Keel, for bringing this forward. And I do like protecting the survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence. And I love our peace officers and correctional officers who help us with public safety. But I want to better understand how big of an impact this is going to have. So my first question, then I'll have another one, Mr. Chair, is how many peace officers and correctional officers are we going to be forwarding mail for? And I just would like to know what kind of volume we're talking in the state.
I think my staff is going to remind me that I need to remove my objection. And without further objection, work order 32-3380/golf is our working document. And now I should be entertaining questions. Do you remember the question, Senator Keel?
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you.
And for the record, Jesse Keel, Senator District Q again. Mr. Chairman, to answer Senator Hughes' question, I don't have a precise number for you. You will see that the Department of Administration had a difficult time estimating as well. We have taken a look at some other states' programs just for sort of proportionality. And so looking at the state of Vermont, which has a roughly comparable population but does not include law enforcement or correctional officers, looking at the state of Arizona, which has about 10 times our population, also does not include law enforcement or corrections. It's our estimate that at full implementation, once it's ramped up over several years, the registry will probably serve somewhere in the neighborhood of 700 to 900 Alaskans. But you will notice, of course, that that number is much less than the number of correctional officers and law enforcement officers in the state, to say nothing of survivors of these crimes. And that's because these registries aren't useful to everyone. Those law enforcement officers who have a significant online presence, who have a Facebook page or have pictures of them in the front yard on their Instagram, an address registry isn't going to do them any good. Now, a young officer starting out who takes seriously the advice that is given at the Public Safety Academy in Sitka, that's given at our correctional officer academies to protect your address, protect your family, to stay off of social media and various other online presences, online locations, they may find great use in this registry. Likewise, the vast majority of folks who go through domestic violence don't ultimately pick up and move. Now, they may get out of bad relationships. We hope that they do. But a comparatively small number of those folks who survive sexual assault, who survive stalking or DV, a comparatively small number of them feel so threatened that they have to restart their lives somewhere else. Those are the people who will use a registry like this and whom it will benefit.
A follow-up? So, you know, victims are in a situation through no fault of their own, so the state helping with that makes sense. And I'm very grateful for law enforcement, but I'm thinking, you know, when you talk about retribution, I could see where judges might want that same option. Even school principals and teachers, maybe even lawmakers at times. I've had people outside my home hackling about an issue before. But we as individuals, we can get a P.O. box, and I think we can use that so our physical address isn't recorded. Is there some if a law enforcement officer or a judge or a school principal or a lawmaker wants to keep their physical address private, can't they already do that by securing their own P.O. box?
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Hughes is correct that level of privacy is sufficient for the vast majority of folks who sometimes get people angry at them. And that very, very, very few folks in our line of work or judges would ever feel the need to go to this level of privacy protection. And certainly we've had conversations with other folks about the bill and about whether we should expand it even further. I'm not aware of any other states whose programs include law enforcement officers or correctional officers. So while we might choose to have a P.O. box so that our personal addresses aren't out there in public. Those folks who seek revenge on law enforcement, those folks who seek revenge on correctional officers, certainly those perpetrators who engage in stalking, they're going beyond an angry afternoon heckling or standing on somebody's doorstep to talk to them. They're really posing a danger. And so that's why the registry cuts off where it does. Certainly we could expand it as far as our imaginations go, but I don't think most of those folks would find the registry useful. They simply aren't faced with as many threats as those who arrest criminals or keep them behind bars.
I have one more follow-up.
Follow-up from Senator Hughes?
So a law enforcement officer who was very concerned, like you said, maybe coming out of the academy and from the get-go is going to stay off of social media and everything and really protect, would all their mail go to this address? So if they ordered from Amazon, things would go there? Because I'm just wondering, is there a way for somebody with very bad intentions to be able to figure out through hacking, that they maybe could if they were able to reach that level? If that, I'm just wondering the volume of mail that the state might be paying to redeliver, it could be considerable. I mean, if we're talking packages and everything, if the person were solely using that P.O. box because they wanted to make sure there would be no way to trace to the physical address, it could be quite a bit of mail.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hughes, that's a fair point, and what you will see in the regulations that set up these registries in most states is that they do deal with non-commercial mail. So it would be your property tax records, it would be your voting registration, it would be any court documents, lawful notices, the things that need to come certified mail, but that the government would not be engaged in forwarding all your packages from Amazon or that one from the plumbing parts website that I'm still waiting on to come to my house. It's been 2 weeks. I'm getting sick of changing drip cloths. I think what we're really dealing with is public records. And so if an abuser, if a criminal were in fact to go out and hack commercial websites or somehow accomplish major data breaches in the commercial world, that would be a separate issue. That, generally speaking, is not what we're worried about when we talk about a stalker, when we talk about a domestic violence abuser, when we talk about someone who's threatening law enforcement. Is it a hypothetical possibility? I suppose most of those folks generally don't pose these kind of computer skills threats.
Okay, thank you. And I'm just thinking there are other prosecutors, tax auditors, there are other people who could suffer from retribution. So I'm just concerned about the fact that some of these folks could just determine to get their own P.O. box. So that's it.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. And I also forgot to mention during the last break, we confirmed that Senator Schauer is on board. Senator Schauer, if you can hear me today, are you out there?
I am out here. I apologize for the delay. I had a hard time getting my phone to accept it, but I have been on for a while. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much. So Senator Hughes' question brought up a question to me. I really wasn't looking for that when I came through here before, but the what you're saying, like when you set up whether it's going to be first-class mail, official documents, if that's set by regulation, that's not set in the statutory law here in front of us, correct? That would be something that would be negotiated in the regulations.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Thank you. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Got a number of questions. Kind of, Senator Hughes asked the preliminary question for about three of my questions. first of all, just kind of with the just looking at the practical side of how this is going to work. So by forwarding mail, who then delivers? Is that still the post office? Is that something? Is that a state employee going to somebody's house? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman, to answer Senator Meyer's question, Yes, that would be the state employee in most of these programs, or in fact, I think in all of them I'm familiar with, would take the forwardable mail, would bundle that in a single envelope, and then mail it to the participant's actual address.
Okay.
Whether that's PO or physical.
Okay, thank you.
Second question?
Yep. So the next question I have related to public records, one piece of public records regarding addresses that's come up lately has been the Real ID Act. And we're now required to get a Real ID compliant identification. We're required to provide proof of address. Will this bill providing that forwardable post office box, is that still going to be Real ID compliant?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I believe that under, I can't pull the specific section, but the state and municipalities would be required to accept the PO box if the bill were to be passed.
Okay. That would, and the federal government would accept that as well then?
Mr. Chairman, we can research that question and get the committee an answer through the DMV. The Department of Administration didn't raise that issue when looking at the bill, but we will get an actual yes or no.
All right, appreciate that. And so the chair understands. Would you restate that question?
So the
proof of identification, is a PO box suitable for proof of ID?
Correct. Yes. The question is in order to get a Real ID compliant driver's license or other piece of ID, you are required to provide proof of address. So often they'll tell you to bring down your electric bill or something of that nature to provide proof of address. The question here is, if you're trying to not provide your address to other people, if providing that PO box will be sufficient to provide a proof of residence to be Real ID compliant.
Thank you, Senator Myers. Is there a third question?
Yeah, I do have one more. Yeah. So I noticed in the bill that we've made it a crime to, and rightly so, to provide. To basically to spill the beans here, to put out the information that we're somebody's real address that we're trying to hide, but I noticed that one of it is not authorized to access the address confidentiality program database and knowingly discloses the information to a respondent to the respondent of a protective order. My question is, why have we not simply made it a crime to access the database when you're not authorized?
Mr. Chairman, in answer to Senator Myers, the notion here has to do with the mental state. The differences in the bill have to do with the mental state for the disclosure. And so, if someone is there at the department running the program and actually gives the information to someone who's not allowed to have it, that's a more serious situation than if someone happens upon the information and knows this person is protected and allows that information to get out into the wrong hands. So those are different things, and the bill treats them with different levels of severity.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other questions from the committee? I'll go to you, Senator Schauer. I know you've already seen this bill in State Affairs. Do you have any questions regarding Senate Bill 115 in Judiciary?
No. I think we answered them all in State Affairs. I see the point of the bill makes sense to me. I have no further questions. Thanks for asking.
All right. So with no further questions for the sponsor, at this point, I'm prepared to set an amendment deadline. And I'd like to have an amendment deadline set by 12 o'clock on Wednesday, March 16th. So please submit them to my office by that time. And at this time, we'll set Senate Bill 115 aside. Senator Keel, do you have any final comments?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the work on the bill today. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Senator Keel. Thank you, Mr. Carrillo. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to bring Senate Bill 115 back before the committee. Public testimony. Technicality. All right, so Senate Bill 105 is back before the committee. I will open public testimony at this time. Public testimony is now open for Senate Bill 115. Is anyone in the office, in the building, in the room, care to offer public testimony? And I'm looking on here. I don't see anyone online. So at this time, we're going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 115. All right, once again, setting Senate Bill 115 aside. All right, Senate Bill 161, political party definition. And we'll bring Senate Bill 161 before the committee. Senate Bill 161 is related to the definition of a political party. This is the first hearing of Senate Bill 161 in Senate Judiciary. Welcome, Senator Wolakowski, to Senate Judiciary. Thanks for taking a seat at the presenter's table. Please introduce your bill and your staff, maybe not in that order.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Wolakowski, State Senator representing East Anchorage and Jaybear, and joining me is David Dunsmore on my staff. And this bill was brought to me by a constituent who's very active in the Libertarian Party. And under existing law, after ballot measure 2, the only way a party can achieve official status is to have registered voters equal to 3% of the total votes in the top of the ticket race in the previous general election. And that number, you have a chart in your file, I believe. That number is roughly 11,000 people. And it's fluctuated because the number of people that vote every year, every couple of years, changes. And just as an example, in 2010, it was a little under 8,000, jumped up to a little under 10,000 in 2016, went back down. This bill just sets a clear number, and it's the number that they chose. And I don't have any particular affiliation for this number, but it was 5,000 registered voters. The Supreme Court has looked at this issue in the past, and in the case of Vogler versus Miller, in 1983 case, there was a state threshold of 10%, and they ruled that was too high. That was unconstitutional, and they said that most states had thresholds in the 2 to 5% range.
That was 2 to 5%?
2 to 5%, yes, Mr. Chairman. And this picks the number of 5,000, which is much lower than our current number. We have corresponded, my staff has with, in the prior committee, had requested to have a Green Party feel about this, had an Alaska Constitution Party. We heard back from the chair of the Constitution Party, and, we had not heard on the Constitution Party, but we had heard back from the Green Party who thought that who did say they supported lowering the threshold. We don't know of any opposition to this. And I'll stop right there. And I guess I can turn it over to my staff if there are technical issues. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Wolakowski. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I noticed that this is the first time that we're updating this this particular part of statute in about 40 years. Since that time, population's gone up around 40%, give or take. I imagine in the next 40 years, the population's going to rise as well. We hope the population rises as well. Do you believe that we should just leave it static and, you know, we'll address it again later, or should we program something into the bill to have a population increase with the census or something like that?
Thank you, Senator Meyer, through the chair. I guess I'm sort of indifferent to it. I think what you want to look for in something like this is some kind of number that shows some substantial support. I think 5,000 is that number. I sort of like the bright line that you have at 5,000, just because it's a bright line and parties know what to shoot for. If the committee decided it was wiser to add a population adjuster, I wouldn't object to that. But 5,000 seemed like a reasonable number to me. Fortunately, we don't have that big population spikes in Alaska. And so if you were adjusted every year, every 10 years, maybe you adjusted by a couple hundred, or I don't know that makes a huge difference. The advantage, I think, of 5,000 it's a bright line for parties to know what to shoot for. That's not going to change.
Thank you, Senator Myers. Thank you, Senator Wolakowski. Are there any other questions for the committee, from the committee? Senator Hughes?
Well, the other way we could do this rather than a number, if 3% is about 10,000, we could do 1.5%, and then that would kind of flow with the population. Would you be adverse to that idea? Or it would accomplish the same thing, I think, and take into consideration Senator Myers' question.
Again, thank you, Senator, through the chair. I don't have personally have a problem with 1.5%. I'd be curious what the public testifiers would have. Again, it was 5,000 was a number that they selected, the libertarians, and they thought that setting a bright line would just be easier. Is there another reason, David, if I could ask my staff?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, for the record, I'm David Dunsmore, staff to Senator Wilichowski. One of the advantages of having a numerical threshold rather than a formula is that the formula fluctuates. And right now we have kind of a counterintuitive phenomenon where, because it's tied to the voter turnout in the previous election and presidential elections pretty universally have a higher voter turnout than midterms, as the chart we prepared shows, and the last election was more of a dramatic bump, but it always kind of bumps up and then bumps back down. So we have kind of a paradoxical situation where the threshold to become a qualified party in a lower turnout midterm election is actually higher than the threshold in a higher turnout presidential election because it's tied to the election previous.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. And I get that. It's like I get the bright line idea. It won't fluctuate with time and maybe fluctuate wildly depending on how popular the presidential election is. Are there any other questions from the committee? I'll just check and confirm with Senator Schauer. I know he's out there. I know he's seen this as I have in state affairs already. Senator Schauer, just want to confirm that you're out there and you don't have any questions.
Just one, very quickly.
Please proceed.
Thanks. I had to say this very quickly, Senator Holland, because that's an hour thing. But what I would ask the sponsor of the bill, we've seen it, and I think the 5,000 bright line is fine for me. I'd pick a number and roll with it versus getting too complicated. But all I would ask is that I know that they were reaching out to some of the other parties just to see if they had inputs on it, and it sounds like there's still a couple we haven't heard from. So just in the interest of trying to be as fair as we can, I just would request that Senator Wilichowski's staff keep trying to reach out and see if we can get the responses from as many as possible. It's just nice to have the buy-in. That's all my only – it's just a request, Mr. Chairman, of the sponsor, that they keep trying to get that information for the committee. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Schauer.
Yeah, and Senator Schauer, through the chair, I would note, and I think I neglected to communicate this with my boss, but after the bill moved out of state affairs, the Constitution Party of Alaska did get back to us, and they support lowering the threshold.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. A brief at ease. Thank you, Senator Judiciary. Back on the record, I just had a technical question for the moderator today. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I noticed in the sponsor statement that mentioned one reason that we are talking about this is ballot access has changed, but we're talking about different APROC rules and things of that nature. I'd just be curious as to what type of, or if you could give me some examples of some of the differences in APOC reporting requirements between the political parties and the political groups, and to see what the advantages and disadvantages are.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, and I can get back to you in writing with more detail in case I miss something. But the two major things are political parties are able to create subdivisions within the party that are treated under the same limit. Whereas an individual, like a group, would have to form a completely separate group, political parties can create subdivisions. Like, I believe both the Democratic and the Republican parties have separate House and Senate campaign accounts. And then the other main thing is a different contribution limit, both for individuals giving to parties and parties giving to candidates.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Dungemore. Thank you, Senator Myers. Are any other questions from the committee? At this point, I'm going to open it up for public testimony. Public testimony is now open. And does anyone in the room wish to offer a public testimony, seeing no one in the room? And I believe online I might have one person wishing to offer a public testimony. Mike Coons, if you care to state your name, any affiliation, and begin your 3 minutes or so of public testimony.
Yeah, this is Mike Coons. You guys hearing me good? I just got myself a brand new phone and just the bad one. You got good?
Sounds like it's working well.
Okay, great. I want to thank Senator Wilkowski on this. Not mainly because of the bill itself, but this gives an indication in listening to his testimony as well that the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, the Constitutional Party, all believe that we're still going to have parties in 2023 upon repeal of the ranked choice voting. I would hope that this is a good indicator that all different parties, be it, doesn't matter if it's Republican or Democrat or some of the outlying ones, still actually believe in party affiliation, primaries to go along with them, et cetera. So this is, to me, you know, I would just on that alone, that brightness of hope that we can get rid of ranked choice voting after this year's debacle, that's why I would be in support of this bill. And I think 5,000 is a perfectly fine line, especially with the smaller different political parties. That's what they've asked for, and if that's what they asked for, then by all means, let them have it. Have a good day.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Coons. Seeing no one else online, I will close public testimony at this time. Public testimony is now closed for Senate Bill 161. This is a very simple bill. It gets rid of 10 or 12 lines of legislation and replaces it with two. So that's always a good sign. But at this point, if members have amendments on this bill, please submit them to my office by 12 p.m. on Wednesday, March 16th. And I will set Senate Bill 161 aside at this time. Senate Bill 189 would have been up next. Senate Bill 189 is on sex trafficking. It was scheduled for today, but won't be heard. We are still not quite ready to bring that committee substitute forward. That being said, the agenda is completed for the day. Is there any other business before this committee? And seeing none, Senator Schauer, you good with adjourning for the day?
Yes, sir.
Our next meeting is Wednesday, March 16th at 1:30 p.m., and we are adjourned at 2:32 p.m.